Elon Musk, how many of you know who Elon Musk is? He's the owner of Tesla, right? Kind of one of the brilliant minds of the electric vehicle. And he was in the news recently because he tweeted his solution to the Ukraine-Russian war. He basically said Ukraine should give up Crimea, give up parts of the Donbass that they're fighting about, and commit itself to neutrality as a way of bringing peace to that part of the world. And you can imagine that his ideas did not get much sympathy in the press. A lot of people objected to his solution to the war. In fact, there was one article in the Globe and Mail that came to my attention. It was where a columnist argued not only against the ideas of Elon Musk, but they argued that it was now time to boycott Tesla Motors, the company that Musk had founded and was now still essentially in control of. They wanted to boycott his company for what he had said. Now, to boycott a business is to try to bring economic pain against that entity. The idea behind the article is that we don't like what Elon Musk said about the Ukraine war. Maybe we don't like a lot of things that Elon Musk has said, and therefore we should punish him by punishing his company. And there's this insidious idea that has been creeping into our culture recently that states that it's not enough simply to disagree with somebody, but you have to punish them for their ideas. You have to hurt them in some way in order to discourage them from saying what they think. See, because in recent times, not that long ago, certainly 50 years ago, it would have been simply enough to write a rebuttal to Elon Musk, to publish your views in opposition to what he was saying. If you don't like someone's ideas, then engage in them, an argument with them. Engage them on their ideas. Argue with them. Point out to them why they're wrong. That was the way we normally resolve these kinds of differences. Like, I personally think that Elon Musk is wrong about the solutions to ending the Ukraine war. But the idea that because I think he's wrong in his assessment of how to bring the war in Ukraine to a completion, that I should take it to the next level, or I should take it up a level and punish him by boycotting his company. I don't make the connection there, personally. Why? We've been talking about stewardship over the past few weeks. Stewardship is the careful and responsible management of something entrusted to one's care. And I've been mentioning to you over the past few weeks that a lot's been entrusted into our care. Our relationships. I mean, we're essentially relational creatures, human beings. We're built for relationships. We have relationships with everyone and everything we can imagine. You can have relationships with people. You can have relationships with creatures. Many of us have pets. We have a relationship, a real relationship with our pets. We can have relationships with the environment. You go out for a walk, you're having a relationship with the world around you. You can have relationships with money, with health, with time. Everything in life has an element of relation to it. Life is relational. It has a relational characteristic about it, which means that the practice of stewardship, the need for careful and responsible management of that which has been entrusted to us, is critical for our lives. And we've looked over the past few weeks about how to steward these relationships. We looked on October 2nd about how to steward our relationships with people. We looked on October 9th about how to steward our relationships with God, our relationship with God. We looked last week about how to steward our relationship with our use of time. Today, I want to talk to you about how to steward our relationship with contrarian voices in our lives. How to bring careful and responsible management to the contrarian voices that come into our lives. Because I think we're living in a time today where there's a strong tendency in our culture, and we're all influenced by it, to ignore or even punish the contrarian voice that comes to us. And from all sides, there's no particular political or philosophical viewpoint that isn't vulnerable to wanting to punish the contrarian voice. We're all vulnerable to this. People today seem less interested overall in listening to voices different from their own. We seem today to look principally for affirmation of what we already believe. We're looking for voices of sympathy for what we already know. When someone comes forward with a perspective different than us, the ones that we have, we don't know often what to do with it. And when we do deal with it, we want to, in some sense, be aggressive against it. And I think the Globe and Mail article is proof of this new spirit that's in our culture, this new mindset that's come about. We just cancel people and their ideas, and we don't like them. We just cancel them out rather than engage with them. And my point to you today is that if we fail to steward those contrarian voices in our lives, in our personal lives and in the world around us, we will all miss out on critical information. You know, when Albert Einstein came out with his general theory of relativity, which is the bedrock of modern physics and modern cosmology, when he came out with his proposal, his general theory of relativity, he ran into considerable resistance within the scientific community. See, because he had a contrarian understanding about how the universe worked. A radically different explanation for the phenomenon that we all experience in life. And 100 scholars wrote an open letter condemning his proposal. They didn't simply disagree with him. They didn't argue with him in the journals. They didn't point out where his ideas were faulty. They actually wrote an open letter condemning him, trying, in a sense, to cancel him by their overwhelming and combined criticism. And just imagine what would have happened if Einstein had been shunted off into the background, if he'd been, in a sense, ignored, suppressed. His ideas about how the universe functioned had been suppressed. You can imagine that our understanding about the physical universe would have been dramatically impacted, diminished. We wouldn't have the world that we do today if we'd ignored his contrarian voice. And it's only later that Einstein's ideas became mainstream. Many of the discoveries in science have come from contrarians, people who have come up with a different idea, who now see the world in a different way. If they presented their ideas, very rarely have they been embraced by either the scientific community or the world at large. Copernicus, who came up with the idea that the sun was at the center of the solar system, he had to die before he was willing to publish his work. He dared not publish it while he was alive. His treatise only got published when he died. It's not that the contrarian voice is always correct. We're not always going to run into Einsteins in life. That's not the case. Often the contrarian voice is mistaken, but nonetheless, even within that mistaken view, there's often insight or knowledge that would otherwise be overlooked or ignored by the world. An opinion can be wrong in the big picture and still have valid points within it. And if we simply dismiss a contrarian point of view because it conflicts with what we already know, as I've been saying, it's likely we're going to miss critical information. Now, none of us like to be criticized. I don't imagine anyone here likes criticism. None of us likes our ideas to be shown to be faulty or even wrong. We prefer it in life when others agree with us. We like sympathetic voices. We like voices of affirmation. But we're not always well served in life if we're only surrounded with those voices, affirming voices, sympathetic voices. We will often miss critical information about ourselves or about life if we only seek the affirming point of view. There's an interesting story about the first President Bush, not George W. Bush, but George H.W. Bush. He was riding high in the polls. It was right after the first Gulf War when he threw out the Iraqis from Kuwait. And he was getting ready for his 1992 re-election campaign, so he sat down in a room full of advisors, political advisors and consultants, and then he went around the room and got their advice, and everyone in the room was excited and hopeful for his re-election. Everyone saw him in a very strong position to win, almost certain to win re-election, everyone except the last person to speak. He was the youngest and most inexperienced of the group. They called him the kid, even though he was in his 30s. He was called the kid. And he had a different point of view of the situation. He held a contrarian point of view. He did not share the consensus rosy picture that the others were presenting to Bush. He saw considerable challenges coming in the horizon for George H.W. Bush, saw difficult hurdles for him that he would need to overcome to be reelected. And at the end of the meeting, this young consultant was politely escorted out of the room and never invited back. And interestingly enough, George Bush lost the 1992 election to Bill Clinton. And it turns out he lost it on the very issues that this young consultant had pointed out to Bush and the group, the points that this young consultant had raised in the meeting. And it gets me thinking that how many people do we escort out of our lives because not only do we disagree with them on matters, but we don't even want to hear what they have to say. We don't want our treasured ideas about ourselves or about things that are important to us in life to be questioned or challenged. But what important critical information are we missing when we're unable to deal with the contrarian voices around us? In my life, personally, it's been my critics who have been ultimately the most helpful to my growth. I don't know if you feel the same way. It's often been uncomfortable in those moments. It's something that at times can be difficult, maybe even moments that are brutal. Sometimes the criticism isn't even fair in the bigger picture of it all. Nonetheless, there's always wisdom and insight in the criticism that has come to me in life. There's an element of truth in it, and I have learned so much from my critics. Now, we need sympathetic voices, too. We need affirming voices, no doubt about that, but we don't need to push away the contrarian voices in our lives, necessarily. The contrarian voice can at times provide us with exclusive information that no one else can give us. Their point of view can allow us an opportunity to see things differently, even to see ourselves differently. You know, it's important to remember that our faith today, the faith that we celebrate here at Trillium, is built on contrarian voices. Israel was the contrarian voice in the ancient Middle East. Everyone else, all other cultures and societies, had an overlapping view of the gods, goddesses, the divine. The only one that was contrary to all that was Israel. Where everyone else had many gods and goddesses, Israel had one God. Where everyone else made statues and idols of their gods, basically projected themselves onto their images of God, Israel had none. Israel alone, of all the ancient cultures, made worship of God conditional upon moral living. Justice was a key feature of worshiping the God of Israel. This is so unlike all the religions of the ancient Middle East. And the prophets of the Old Testament, they were contrarians at heart too. They spoke a message to the people, to the authorities, that no one wanted to really hear. They had a vision for the present, and they had a vision for the future that many could not accept. Our Bible is filled with their voice. Jesus was a contrarian in his time. He offered a fresh and new understanding of God. He provided new insights into God's ways, new ways of seeing people, new practices for living. And the world got tired of dealing with this contrarian voice, and they escorted him out of the room, so to speak, in a very brutal way. Martin Luther, the instigator of the Protestant Revolution, was a contrarian. He questioned the authority of the Roman Catholic Church. He challenged the church in its moral practices and some of its core teachings, offered people a new way to worship God as a follower of Jesus Christ. John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, the spiritual heritage that this church here, Trillium, is connected into, was a contrarian. He had a spiritual awakening that caused him to see the Christian faith in a new way. He invited people to share with him this new experience of God, and ultimately this led him out of the Anglican Church. Today, the church is the contrarian voice in our culture. Your presence here, You're contrarians by being here. You're now the minority. We speak in a way that runs against the wisdom of our age, like loving our enemy, like loving the person who brings a contrarian voice to us. That's radical thinking today. The biblical perspective is certainly not in vogue at the moment, and that puts us on the outside in a somewhat uncomfortable place. Who wants to be the contrarian? It's a tough place to be. When you're out of step with the world around you, with everyone else who's speaking, it can be at times a lonely place. You know, and within one lifetime, we've gone from being the sympathetic, affirming voice to now the contrarian voice, and people today struggle with us in a way they didn't 50 years ago or 100 years ago. You know, sometimes the contrarian perspective comes not from words or ideas, but from the events of our lives. Most people want a peachy keen life. What do we complain about? We complain about things when they're not peachy keen for us. We want minimal problems and challenges. That's the blessed life according to the world. But when we don't get these contrarian events, what do we do with them? Well, we don't really want to deal with them. Ideally, these contrarian events are situations we would prefer to avoid, like the health challenges that burst into our peace, or the economic challenges that come to us and we feel the precariousness of life. Well, we might run up against a situation that challenges our own sense of competency. Or we struggle with people we love who are in difficult circumstances that we can't solve for them. Or maybe an important relationship fractures and we feel isolated, alone, vulnerable. These are contrarian experiences that no one in their right mind would choose for themselves, yet James says to us that we're not to fear them. When the contrarian events in life come to us, and they can come to us in various forms. They come to us in various ways. When those very contrarian events come to us, a voice, in a sense, speaks through them, speaks through our life circumstances. And these life circumstances can provide us new insight and wisdom, can help us to see life in new ways. James, in fact, says that when the contrarian voice comes to us in our life circumstances, in the events of our lives, we should rejoice. We should be happy about it. In the same way that we should really rejoice when a helpful critic points something out to us. Because in our tough life circumstances, we can be led to a more mature and complete faith. We can grow in our trust with God as we move through tough life circumstances. The hard moments in life are not necessarily a form of punishment given to us, nor are they necessarily a signal of God's disapproval about us. Quite the opposite. They're meant at times to be a place of refinement for us as followers of Jesus. The contrarian moments are pregnant. They're full of possibility for us. And James says, don't try to escort those contrarian moments in your life out the door, because you'll be missing something really important. The meaning of what they're really about will be lost if you try to push them away from you. We are called by God to steward the contrarian voice in life. The contrarian voice that can come through people, the contrarian voice that can come to us through life circumstances, but always given to us for the purposes of our own spiritual, personal growth. So you got to believe that, or the contrarian events of life will have no meaning for you. They'll just be a place of pain and suffering. If you don't believe that there's some kind of higher intelligence at work in your life, at work in the world around you, then you will be like a wave of sea blown and tossed about by the wind, by the contingent circumstances of life. And they will have no meaning for you. Which is why, again, we must steward the contrarian voices in our lives. Welcome people into our lives who see the world differently than we do. Try to understand them. Try to struggle with them. Argue with them, even, but never condemn them and never try to punish them or escort them out of your presence. We must steward the contrarian people and events of our lives, recognize the potential for wisdom embedded in them, not run away, but confidently embrace those circumstances and then move through them with the belief that there is a promise in them waiting for us, a promise that will lead us to a more mature and faithful life. And one of the good things about coming to Trillium is that you're going to get a good chance to deal with contrarian people here all the time. Trillium's full of contrarian people. You're going to get a chance to practice what it means to welcome the contrarian voice into your life. You'll get the chance to practice the stewardship of the contrarian voice, because there's lots of people here today who will see things differently than you do. Lots of people who will challenge your assumptions, frustrate you, baffle you at times in their thinking, perhaps open you to new ways of understanding, become catalysts for growth, lead you to greater insight and wisdom. And in the midst of all of this, we hope that we together will hear the voice of God, which is the ultimate contrarian voice at life, at work in the world. That contrarian voice of God that tells us that the only thing that ultimately matters in all the noise and drama of life is love. In the end, it's only the love given and received that matters. That's a tough position to accept, you know. That contrarian voice of the gospel is that the contrarian voice of the gospel that whatever the differences we might share together today, all the ways that we might aggravate each other, all the ways we might frustrate each other in the midst of it all, there's still ultimately no barrier to loving one another. There's no barrier to love. That's the gospel. Our love for each other is not conditioned upon our agreement with each other. It's not based on our being sympathetic always or affirming voices of each other. We don't have to agree with each other on every matter in life in order to love each other. God loves us, and we can love each other. The gospel.